I'm going to do something I've done this occasionally in the past, and it's kind of unorthodox, but it's the easiest way for me to handle this, and so I just ask you to bear with me as I do it. I'm not going to read from the ESV. I'm going to read from the NIV, and I'm going to read from three different accounts all woven together. I've done this sort of thing in the past. And so I just ask you, you can look at Mark if you'd like, open to Mark chapter 5, and that's the longest of the three synoptic accounts, and so you're welcome to read that, but it may throw you off because there's a lot more detail in the other Gospels woven into that account in a different translation. But in any case, suit yourself if you'd like to read along with me, Mark chapter 5, verses 1 through 20. I'm going to be reading this harmony of all three accounts all the way to the end. This deals with a text that I don't think I've ever dealt with here before, but my memory is so bad and I'm so perpetually distracted I can't be sure. In any case, would you stand with me, please, while I read Kermit Zarley's Harmony of the Gospels. They sailed to the region of the Gadarenes, which is across the lake from Galilee. When he arrived at the other side, Jesus got out of the boat. When Jesus stepped ashore, he was met by two demon-possessed men coming from the tombs. They were so violent that no one could pass by that way. One, a demon-possessed man from the town, for a long time had not worn clothes or lived in a house, but had lived in the tombs. No one could bind him anymore, not even with a chain. Many times an evil spirit had seized him, and though he was chained hand and foot and kept under guard, he tore the chains apart and broke the irons on his feet. No one was strong enough to subdue him. He had been driven by the demon into solitary places. Night and day, among the tombs and in the hills, he would cry out and cut himself with stones. When he saw Jesus from a distance, he ran and fell on his knees at his feet. He cried out, shouting at the top of his voice, "What do you want with me, Jesus, Son of the Most High God? Have you come here to torture us before the appointed time? I beg you, don't torture me. Swear to God that you won't torture me." For Jesus had commanded him, "Come out of this man, you evil spirit." Then Jesus asked him, "What is your name?" "My name is Legion," he replied, "for we are many," because many demons had gone into him. And he begged Jesus again and again not to send them out of the area, not to order them to go into the abyss. Some distance from them, a large herd of pigs was feeding on the nearby hillside. The demons begged Jesus, "If you drive us out, send us into the herd of pigs. Allow us to go into them." He gave them permission. He said to them, "Go." When the demons came out, they went into the pigs. The whole herd, about 2,000 in number, rushed down the steep bank into the lake and were drowned. When those tending the pigs saw what had happened, they ran off and reported all this, including what had happened to the demon-possessed men in the town and countryside. Then the whole town went out to see what had happened. When they came to Jesus, they saw the man who had been possessed by the legion of demons sitting there at Jesus' feet, dressed and in his right mind, and they were afraid. Those who had seen it told the people how the demon-possessed man had been cured and told about the pigs as well. Then all the people of the region of the Gadarenes began to plead with Jesus to leave their region because they were overcome with fear. So he got into the boat and left. As Jesus was getting into the boat, the man from whom the demons had gone out begged to go with him. Jesus did not let him, but sent him away, saying, "Return home to your family and tell them how much God has done for you and how the Lord has had mercy on you." So the man went away and told all over town and began to tell in the Decapolis how much Jesus had done for him. And all the people or amazed. Please be seated. This story is divided up into several parts. The first, of course, deals with the man and his demons, or rather, we should say, the demons and their man, because he is completely in their possession, not vice versa. And then with Jesus' encounter with this man and the demons who are in possession of him, and then the cure that is effected and how it is effected, and the consequences of it for a herd of pigs and also for the local people who are living there in the Gadarenes, in that general area where this man originally hails from. And then what happens to the man himself, and how this touching of his life by the Lord changes him, and the ways in which that impacts the surrounding area. So this is Gentile territory into which Jesus is going. And you may be familiar with the context immediately preceding this. He's been engaged in ministry throughout Galilee. So he's been going from town to town throughout Galilee, proclaiming the gospel, healing people, dealing with the opposition of the religious leaders. And he's been housed in Capernaum. That's been his residence, chief residence, out from which he's gone on these various missionary journeys. And at this point, he gets into a boat with his disciples, and they start across the Sea of Galilee to the other side. And as they're going, a storm overtakes them. You remember that. And Jesus is asleep in the stern of the boat on a cushion at the time. And finally, in desperation, because his disciples fear they're going to be swamped and sink, wake him up and in effect accuse him of not caring about their lives. And so he gets up and rebukes the wind, and the sea is calm, and not long afterwards they arrive at their destination on the opposite side of the lake from Galilee. So they are now on the eastern shores of the Sea of Galilee, having started out on the western shores. So I guess one of the things that occurred, there are many things in this story, and it's almost too rich. There's just almost too much stuff in here to deal with in a single time that we have here. But I'm going to try to hit on some of this stuff because it's really a great story. It has a lot of very practical lessons for us. It's not just about demons and demon possession, but it's really about the Lord himself, and about this great contest that he has with the devil. Some of this is purely speculative on my part. You'll have to bear with me. But I wonder about the storm. You know, he's on his way over to the other side of the lake. I wonder about why he's going there. Why would Jesus go to the opposite side of the Sea of Galilee when he's been ministering on the other side, the west side, in Galilee proper, among the Jews? Because on the other side of the lake, it's not Jewish. It's Gentiles, the pigs, remember? The pig herders. These are Gentiles. So he's deliberately going there, taking his disciples. This is a deliberate move on the Lord's part. Well, it's because he's the Lord of the Gentiles. He's come to save the Gentiles. And he's come to do so through this particular individual. This particular individual is about as needy as a guy as anybody could get, or anybody could be. And the Lord has him in his sights. That is what he's going there to do. He knows what the end of this whole thing is going to be. His disciples, of course, are probably completely oblivious to his plans. But devils being who they are, they also know what his game plan is. They know he's coming. Even these devils who have gained possession of this poor soul over there on the opposite side of the lake, and I personally believe that the storm is demonic in nature. Now you say, well, God is the Lord of storms. Satan doesn't have anything to do with storms. That's not his province. Well, you're wrong about that. Because in the book of Job, you'll remember he was responsible for the whirlwind. Remember that? He was the one who stirred up the whirlwind which smote the four corners of the house in which Job's sons and daughters were celebrating, and killed them all. So the devil is Lord of storms. He's the Lord's devil. He has no ultimate power, but he has real power, even over such things as storms. I personally believe he stirred up the lake, seeking to prevent Jesus from ever getting to his destination, this demon-possessed man. However you may want to view that, the fact of the matter is that the boat is not swamped and Jesus does obtain his destination, and it's clear from the conclusion of the story that he really has this man clearly in his sights and beyond him that whole Gentile area. Because this man is going to be a very effective minister of the Lord Jesus Christ throughout that area. So, you know, that's the prelude to this particular story. And then Jesus gets out of the boat, he steps ashore, and as soon as he does so, there are two demon-possessed men in this story, but the focus very quickly shifts to just one of them, who is the chief character. They're both healed, but one of them is in a much worse condition than the other, as we'll see as this narrative unfolds. And so this demon-possessed man is from the town. He's a local guy. But for a long time, he's been out here. And the authors of the gospel narratives, the synoptics, tell us that he's naked, that he has not lived in a house for a long time, but that he's lived in the tombs. And so we don't know anything about how old this guy is, but we do know for a long time he's been out here by himself and that he's naked. Now, why would that be? Why would this guy be naked? And why would there be, because the demon who is the spokesman for the other demons who have possessed this guy, Jesus asks him his name. Did you ever think of that? The demons have names? Well, I mean, they do, right? We all have names. All of God's creatures have names. No doubt the Lord himself named them. They have different names now, obvious, which fits their personalities, their being, and their works. But in any case, when he asks the spokesman for this crowd, what is your name? The spokesman, using the organs of speech of this man, who is his prize, his possession now, says, Legion, for there are many of us. Well, a legion was 6,000 Roman soldiers. That's not to say that the demons in number are actually 6,000, but only that there is a very large number of them in residence in this man. Why? Why would they do that? Why would they why would so many of them take up residence in this man? Well, how does that happen to begin with? You know, Jesus says, to whomever you give yourself, you will be his, and he will take possession of you. He's speaking both in terms of our giving ourselves to evil and to the devil, or giving ourselves to the Lord. If we give ourselves to the Lord, he takes possession of us. That's a good thing. The more we give ourselves to him, the more he takes possession of us. And that is an ongoing, escalating reality in the life of the people of God. It's also true in the world of demons. This guy, maybe because of some physiological weakness that he had, fell easy prey, perhaps easier prey to devils than the hoi polloi, the common ordinary people do. Because, you know, some of us are born with infirmities, physical, emotional, mental. It's the structure of a cursed humanity in a world which is run amok because it's the possession of the god of this present order, who himself is evil and bent on destruction. So, we don't know how this man became possessed, but I dare say he opened himself up in a measure to these demonic forces, who no doubt had some influence in leading him into that particular action. But he opened himself up to them. Now, there are all kinds of different ways that that can happen. For example, in the case of Saul, you remember, as he departed from the Lord gave him over to an evil spirit. You remember that? The evil spirit didn't live in him, but every now and then it came upon him in a powerful way, and a way of torment. And the relief was brought through David, who strummed the harp for him, the lyre. And so the Lord, in response to that, brought relief to Saul. But Saul opened himself up to this devil's work in his life. This man, in some way, did that. And these devils, probably not all of them at once, but one after another, and then maybe in pairs, and then maybe in companies, took possession of him. Why? Why? Well, again, this is speculative on my part, but I think it's completely consistent with the scriptures. I think it's a good and necessary consequence of the scriptures. Devils were made for us. They were. The angels are made for us. They are servants. They will be forever. That was, I think, what stuck on the devil's craw to begin with. He just couldn't bring himself, could not reconcile himself to that kind of a reason for being. To be the servant of these clots of clay? You got to be kidding me. A soul with my dimension? My power, my wisdom to serve these lowly creatures. But that's the way it was supposed to be. And devils would have found, just as angels are going to find, their whole reason for being in that service. Because, what is it about angels, right? They rejoice when one sinner is saved. More than 99 who never... Why? Why would they want us saved? I mean, look at what they have to deal with us. Look how offensive we are in their sights, a stench in their nostrils, because they have their father's heart, and they're getting it more and more and more as history unfolds, because they're seeing more and more and more of what he's like, how good he is, how patient he is, how loving he is. So they love him more, and they love us more on that account. So they're finding their place as these ministering servants, the hosts of the Lord. Well, in the end, what will it be to be an angel? To be able to bask in the glory, if you will, of having brought the purposes of God to fruition regarding the salvation of his people, because they're involved in it. Just like they rescued Peter from the jail, remember that? An angel did that. They're involved in it. They glory in it in the end. And we in them, there will be, I believe, a fellowship between ourselves and them. They were created for love. Demons were, but went astray. But it's still important to them in a perverse kind of way. They really can't live without men. They were made for men. And so, because they are now controlled by evil, this man is important to him, who has really opened himself up to them, abandoned himself. And so they possess him. He is a prize, a trophy of the highest magnitude to these snakes. And they are in control of him, and they are empowering him. He's got unusual powers, powers like Samson had. Why did Samson have those powers? Because he was indwelled by the Spirit of the Lord, right? The Spirit of the Lord came upon him, and he broke the bands like they were threads. These spirits have empowered this man. He's so strong that nobody can bind him. They've tried. They actually had him chained at different times, hand and foot, but he was able to break free of those bonds. They posted guards around him. Nothing could contain him. His power was unstoppable and insurmountable. And so he's alone out there in wild places, a wild man, naked. I think, again, the nakedness is part of their possession of him, the totality of his humanity, and sort of a celebration of the shame that they are partaking of with him and the way in which his humanity has been so completely, the image of God has been so completely defaced in him. It's almost as though he's a devil incarnated at this point. He's so much in control of these evil serpents. And why solitary places? Well, You remember the Screwtape Letters in which C.S. Lewis paints a picture of hell? And what does everybody in hell try to do? You remember that? They all try to get farther and farther away from one another. Incidentally, there's no place to go in hell. You're all as close can be together. That's part of the agony of it. But in the present order of things, people want to be away from people because other people confront them with their... you go into a big city and you go into condominiums and you find people who've lived across from one another in a hallway for 20, 30 years and don't even know one another's names. You know, it's too painful to get close because when you get close, you're vulnerable. People might see you for who you are. You might be called upon to do stuff that you can't, right? And so it's comfortable to be alone because no demands on you there. And so this man wants to be alone, partly because of his shame. And he's tormented. He cries out. He lives in tombs. We're not told what he eats. We can only imagine, right? Living in tombs. Night and day, he's out in the tombs and in the hillsides crying out. This man is in an agony because of the possession of these demons, cutting himself with stones. On the one hand, he wants to self-destruct. And on the other hand, of course, his life is valuable. On the one hand, the demons want to destroy him. And on the other hand, if they do destroy him, then they lose their home. The tensions, huh? The tensions of wickedness as it works out on the stage of history in men and devils. There are lots of them in this story. And so here he is, a man of unspeakable torment, all alone and lonely. Why would people have anything to do with him? Well, because he's a nuisance and he's a threat. That's the only reason anybody goes out there. They try to put him in chains, they post a guard, because he's a threat to them, not because they have any concern at all for his spiritual welfare, for his physical welfare. He's an anathema to them, and they're frightened of him. He's beyond their ability to minister to. That's their point of view on it. And so there he is, alone, living in the tombs, solitary places, cutting himself with stones. This possession is gradual. It tells us that many times the demon seized him, and eventually the demon moves in and is joined by that force of others. And so he is now, at this point when Jesus arrives on the scene, he has been completely mastered. And so he is the exclusive possession of this horde of evil spirits. And then he sees Jesus at a distance, and he runs and falls on his knees. Now, one of the things you have to remember in this, and I don't understand a whole lot about demon possession, but, you know, we're psychosomatic creatures, and demons possess people psychosomatically. They are in them body and soul. And so they have power over brain states, for example. You say, oh, that's rubbish. You're talking about things you don't know anything about, Greg, and you keep on giving us your opinions. We're interested in the word. But you remember that the angel who released Peter from prison shut down all the guards. You remember that? How did he do that? Well, he got into their heads is how he did it. And he twinked the chemistry there, and he shut them down. He put them to sleep. Demons can't do that. Oh, yeah, they can. It's right there in the book of Acts. They've got that kind of power over the sons of Adam. This man is possessed in that way by these demons. They're in his head, and by that, in his heart, and in his mighty limbs. Really quite a thing when you think about it. Quite a thing. So, Jesus comes on the scene, and this poor soul comes and rushes at him. Now, this is the guy who wants to be alone, remember. This is the guy who's possessed of demons, who hate Jesus Christ, who are filled not only with hatred, but fear. You know the old expression, fear and loathing, you know where that comes from? That's who the devil is. He's full of it. And this man and the demons possessing him are full of it. But remember, this man who is in the possession of these demons is still a man. He's still a creature of God. And there is something that resonates here in this man when Jesus steps out of the boat. Because you can be sure Jesus has his eyes locked on this man. And he knows what he's going to do. So this man comes trembling, falling at his ground, crying out at the top of his voice, shouting, "What do you want with me, Jesus, Son of the Most High God? Have you come here to torture us?" It's the demon speaking. It's also the man speaking. "Have you come here to torture us before the appointed time?" Guilt, right? Demons have a lot of that. They know what their destiny is. That's all they can conceive God of, as a destroyer. Isn't that interesting? When you become a destroyer, you have no other choice but to view God as destroyer. Interesting, isn't it? How evil perverts our understanding of all things. "Have you come to torture us before the time?" He says it twice. Three times, I'm sorry. "I beg you, don't torture us. Swear to God that you won't torture me." Here's the spokesman for the tribe that's in residence here. For Jesus had commanded him, "Come out of this man, you evil spirit." I wish you could get the picture of this scene, this man in the state that he's in, and Jesus there, and his disciples behind him watching all of this. And this dialogue that's going on, because Jesus is already commanding this demon to come out. And great resistance is being met, so much so that the Lord stops the command and asks for some ID. "What's your name?" he asks. "Legion, for we are many." And he begged Jesus again and again not to send them out of the area, not to order them to go into the abyss. Now, what is the abyss? I think it speaks of a place where they are incapacitated in some way, so that they're not free to do what they want to do. And that would be, I mean, they're not there in a permanent state when that's where they end up. Jesus tells us that when a demon comes out of a man, it wanders about in dry, arid places for a while, and then it goes back. It finds its home, its former home, swept in order, and then it goes and gets seven other demons worse than itself, and they move back in. So it's not as though a demon is cast out of a man or knocked out of a mission, that it's a permanent state of affairs. They do their master's bidding, and sooner or later they're back in the saddle and bringing about their destructive purposes, however and wherever they may. And he didn't want to go out of the area. He didn't want to, the demons didn't want to come out of this man. They didn't want to leave the area because it was the man and it was the area in which they were exercising this control. In any case, some distance away is this large herd of pigs. And so they're feeding on the hillside. And according to the comments in Zarley's book at the end of it, they're about a mile apart. These tombs are still there and the Gadarenes, and this steep hillside is about a mile away where all these pigs are grazing. And so they beg Jesus, "If you drive us out, send us into the pigs." And, you might say to yourself, well, why would they want to go into the pigs? Well, I think this is just a ruse. They know what they're going to do once they get into the pigs. They can dispense with the pigs. They don't mind killing them. And then they're free, at least, to stay in the area and to cause more trouble. So that's why they want to go in. That's my take on it anyways, why they want to go into this herd of pigs. And so they are allowed to. He gave them permission. He says, go. And so the demons come out and go into this herd of pigs, and the whole herd, about 2,000 in number, rushes down the steep bank and is drowned in the lake. And there are all kinds of things about that. That pigs, animals, in some way have a heart. that's taught in a number of places in the Bible, not least of which when Nebuchadnezzar is given the heart of a beast. It's not a man's heart, it's a beast's heart, but it's a heart nevertheless. You own dogs, right? You've watched dogs dream by the fireside. Right? You can't dream without a mind. In order to have dreams, you have visions of some sort, you have images in your head. So, in some sense, not a man's heart, don't get me wrong about that. Beasts' hearts. Beasts' hearts are not men's hearts, but they have a heart of some sort. And so do these pigs into whom these demons go and drive into the lake to destroy. And so now, the scene has changed because this man is completely healed. He's in his right mind. Somebody among the disciples, presumably, is willing to part with some clothing, and so they get him dressed, and he's sitting there in front of the Lord in his right mind. And the pig herders have all hightailed it into town. They don't own the pigs, they're just caring for them, to tell, first of all, the owners of what has happened, but also other people. This would have been astounding news to anybody in the area, that this man who had caused so much trouble and had been so unmanageable and so obviously completely unique respecting who he was, the sorts of powers that he exercised. They're all brought out here from the town and the surrounding area to the place in which this miracle has come. And the reason for it is that they see Jesus as a threat. They never cared about this man. That was never in their concern. They could have cared less what happened to him as long as he didn't bother them anymore. But they see Jesus as a troublemaker. You know, he's done this with pigs, so he's already hitting us where we live in terms of our pocketbooks. So what other trouble is this dude going to cause if he remains in the area? They recognize he has extraordinary powers. They beg him to leave. They don't command him to leave. They beg him to leave. They want nothing to do with him. They want nothing to do with his ministry. They do not want his gospel. They want him and the word of the Lord he speaks out along with his powers over darkness. But the man, on the other hand, what about him? He's in his right mind now because these demons are no longer in possession of him. And not only is he in his right mind, but he's in his right heart. He's come to know Jesus Christ as the one who has power to set him free from a bondage which has got to be virtually unparalleled. He is a free man, face to face with the lover of his soul, who has set him free from these demons who tormented him, and justly so, because he was a sinner, an evil man who'd opened himself up to them in some way, at some point in his life. Now, actually, in a living relationship with the Lord of glory himself. And so Jesus makes to take off. He steps into the boat to leave. And this man begs him to go with him. That's what he wants more than anything else at this point, because of the way in which Jesus has touched his heart. He wants to be in the presence of Jesus Christ. Wherever he goes, this man wants to go. He's his follower from now on. He would be his disciple from now on. But Jesus says, no. No, I don't want you to come with me. So rather than coming, I want you to go. I want you to go back to your home and to your family. This guy had a family. He had a home in this nearby town. And I want you to tell them what great things the Lord has done for you. And so this man does just that in response to the Lord's command. But not only does he go home and tell his family, not only does he tell his neighbors and other people living in that town, but he goes beyond that town to the other towns, every town in the area, the whole Decapolis, proclaiming what Jesus Christ has done for him, bearing testimony, testifying to the grace of God which he's come to experience through Jesus Christ. And so you could see this man is completely turned around, completely rescued and set free. And these forces of darkness, which have had such a field day in this man, are now overthrown. And light now shines into this dark area, the Decapolis, this Gentile region, as a result of what Jesus Christ has done. So, you know, what are the lessons of this? Well, not least of them, of course, is the fact that Jesus is the same yesterday, today, and forever. He still has power over demonic forces. He still has power over the devil, who is very real and who is our enemy, who we're cautioned as a roaring lion seeking whom he may devour. He prowls about. He's the tempter. He's the destroyer, the murderer, the deceiver. That's the game plan. That's who this character is. And he has an army of demons at his disposal to accomplish those evil purposes of his. And we would be in the same boat with this man, ultimately. We would be overwhelmed by them, possessed by them, and destroyed by them, were it not for the Lord, who on the cross subjects himself to these devils. They never possess him. They have no place in him. He tells us that. You have no place in me. They have no place in him. But they subject him to the torments. Do his people like the torments of this poor soul whom he rescued? And rather than being mastered in any way by them, he masters them. How? By taking away from them the field of their endeavor. He rescues a humanity which was rightfully theirs. He rescues them by forgiving their sins and by giving them a brand new heart so that they really and truly are the sons and daughters of God. And therefore, they are rescued from his dominion. And so all that he can do ultimately by way of destruction to the people of God, Jesus Christ undoes by his rescue of us from sin and consequences on Calvary. So as I've said before, you know, the devil is still a mighty foe, but all he can do right now in the hands of God is to bless us. The very worst that he can do is to bless us. Even as we see that evidence, for example, in the life of Job. I mean, we see it evidenced first and foremost in the life of Christ himself, but we see it evidenced in the life of Job. Whom the Lord gives the devil free reign over, except that he has to spare his life. But what is the end of it all? You know, it's just growth in grace for Job, in knowledge of God, in knowledge of himself, in holiness, in love for Christ, in desire to serve Christ, in fruitfulness for Christ. It's all the devil can ever do. Ultimately, he can't harm us. Ultimately, we don't need to fear him. He's a defeated foe. Another lesson in this story is that when Jesus Christ rescues us from the powers of darkness, it may even be just from the powers of the darkness of our own hearts, we should be doing what? We should find ourselves like this guy who want to be close to him and who can't for a while, right? He's an absentee landlord right now. The world is his and we are his. But he isn't immediately present with us. He's present by his Spirit. And he's really present by his Spirit. But we don't have the closeness to him now that we're going to have in the end. Meanwhile, what can we do to show that Jesus Christ is ours and that he loves us? How can we love him in turn? Well, we can be like this guy, who formerly didn't want to be with anybody. He was a loner, right? A sort of the quintessential recluse. And now, he's out there mixing it up with everybody. Every town he can get into, he's going to share the good news of Jesus Christ. He can't wait to tell people this glorious gospel, this transforming power. Formerly, he knew what power was. He knew the power that he had through these demons who lived in him. He knew their power. Now, he's marching to the tune of a different drummer, and he knows a different power, the saving, loving, gracious power of Jesus Christ. Are we like that? Are we like that? Are we excited by our relationship with the Lord so that we want to give our hearts to him and serve him in whatever way he calls us? Are we willing to do what he says? Because that's what this guy does, right? Jesus says, go. And he goes. He does just what the Lord tells him to do. So this guy is in glory today. He's one of those witnesses, right? Like the ones surrounded that are mentioned in the 12th chapter of Hebrew. That cloud of witnesses that have gone on before and encouraging us to be the same in terms of our relationship with Christ, who rescues us from the powers of darkness and from all of the demonic influences that they can exert over us, that sets us free in this love relationship and love feast with the Lord so that we may live for Him. Well, may that be our portion. Let's pray. Thank you, Father, for this amazing story, so rich in so many ways. There's so much information here about so many things. But that's the central feature, that you are a lover of men, and the most unlikely candidates for your love. You cross lakes through storms in order to get to manifest your glorious loving power. And this is who you are. You're not afraid of demons. You're not afraid of demon-possessed men. Your love breaks through all of that and rescues them, plucks them right out of hell, right out of the devil's lap, and delivers them into the lap of your Father forever. How can we help but worship you? How can we help but love you, who have such a love for such awful souls as we ourselves are? Because if we look at ourselves, Lord, we are no better, no different than this man. We have made ourselves liable to be destroyed by our enemy. And yet you have loved us out of his domain and into yours, that everlasting kingdom. So may our hearts resonate with this, Lord, and may it percolate down into our feet and out into our limbs and our lips, that we may give our hearts an adoring wonder to service to you and to that eternal kingdom which your Son Jesus is bringing to bear right now, because we ask it in his name. Amen. In conclusion, would you turn with me to hymn number 634?